Once again, we hear foolishness. Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principled Policy. And along with me today is our co-host, the Vice Chairman of the Institute, my fellow analyst and very good friend, Chuck Michaelis.
Good to be back with you again, Barry. Nice to be out here in a nice, bright, early fall morning. It's a little crisp here. It's not as crisp as it's going to get.
No, we're right now experiencing the end of a summer swelter, I guess is what you would call it, even though that as we record this, Chuck, officially on my calendar, it's saying that today is the first day of fall.
Yes.
Well, and yes, I've seen some leaves dropping, mainly from dehydration, but other than that, it doesn't quite feel like it. I know here in our little bend to the river, we're looking at 90 plus degrees again today, and doesn't look like it's going to break anytime soon. So,
well,
lovely thought, but you know, that's the way it goes. You know, sometimes you just have to deal with things that you just can't control.
Well, that's it. And despite the fact that we have a lot of people that claim it, man doesn't have any say over what the climate is. We can pump all the CO2 into the atmosphere that we want to. There's a saturation level, and it doesn't get any higher than that. And that really has minimal effect on the climate, despite the, you know, the greenhouse gas theories and that kind of thing. So, yeah. Well, our deal is to sit back, enjoy what God gives us, be it rain, be it freezing, be it warm days, whatever. Just enjoy it and give thanks for it.
Indeed. Now, there are some things that we can't control right now, Chuck, that we're not really quite as thankful for because, as I mentioned in our opening line, we're back around to foolishness again. Now, for those of you who kind of laughed when you heard that open up and thinking, oh, yeah, they're talking about themselves once more. So, yeah, you could be right. I mean, it depends on how you take the information that we try to provide to you. Either you find it to be beneficial and have some wisdom to it, or you feel it's complete foolishness. And if you feel it's complete foolishness, you're only listening here for a laugh, and that's okay. But, Chuck, there are some things that I'm not laughing about, and one of them is the fact that as we're recording this on the first day of fall, September 22nd, for our Saturday program, right now in Williamsburg, Virginia, Colonial Williamsburg, you've been there, I've been there, it's a gorgeous place, it's wonderful, but the big problem is that right now it's filled with a group of people who are engaging in what I consider to be pure foolishness. And what I'm talking about, Chuck, is the Convention of States Project. I am talking about the folks who believe that they can call for and get their state legislatures to call for another constitutional convention, although they would argue that that's not what they're doing.
That's right.
Because there's a different animal called a Convention of States, which is absolutely completely different, although it's authorized exactly under the same article of the U.S. Constitution that the dreaded constitutional convention is authorized by, but that means that they're completely different animals and they operate under completely different sets of rules. Well, again, Chuck, foolishness. You and I both know that. Our listeners, if they've listened to us for any length of time, know that that's foolishness. But here we go again, because we have probably somewhere in the neighborhood of 200 people who have descended upon Colonial Williamsburg, members of the state's assemblies. I know the three people who have gone from Ohio, Chuck. It's absolutely ludicrous.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I know these three. They're all considered fairly conservative, and they are out there for 3 days. Now, this started yesterday on the 21st and goes through Friday on the 23rd. So by the time our folks hear this, this practice convention will be in the books. Thank goodness it has no legal bearing and it has no authority, much like many of the other state conventions that have been held throughout history that we've talked about before, like the Annapolis Convention and the Hartford Convention and some other conventions that have gone on. We can call this the Williamsburg Convention, Chuck, I think. But, you know, it never ceases to amaze me, and I'm sure that it doesn't cease to amaze you, that the leaders of this particular movement will stop at nothing in order to bring us to a point that they will have no control over. Although they fool themselves into believing that they will be completely the ones in control and nothing bad can happen, Chuck, because of all the safeguards that they personally assure us will be there when this entity is given legal status under the Article 5 of the United States Constitution.
Well, okay, first of all, let's debunk some myths before we even go into the talking about of this thing, because this lie has been repeated, and I've noticed they've stopped using it because we have so effectively, and I mean we, it's not just you and me, it's a whole group of us out here who are opponents to an Article 5, and folks, right on its face, I will tell you I'm an opponent, and in spite of the things that you'll hear, which are laughable, we don't get any Soros money. George Soros is not funding the Institute for Principled Policy, nor any of its activities, I can assure you. The idea suddenly that somehow this is a safe process, and the argument has been and continues to be, the states call this convention, and Mark Levin was actually saying this, and I haven't heard him say it in a while, and I think he stopped saying it, and that is that basically the states simply call the convention, notify the federal government, and go ahead and have it. Well, that's not the way this works, and the language of Article 5 makes it very, very, very clear that this is not the case. In fact, the opening phrases of Article 5, the Congress, whenever two-thirds of both houses shall deem it necessary, shall propose amendments to this Constitution, or, on the application of the legislatures of two-thirds of the several states, shall call a convention for proposing amendments. And that, the key word in that second phrase there is application of the legislatures of two-thirds of the several states, application being the operative phrase. Application means that the states are not in control of the process. The federal government is.
Right, exactly.
And there is no requirement, and I will bring it up again, as I've said over and over and over again, there's no requirement that the states be the ones to appoint delegates.
Well, and think about this, Chuck. Okay, application. Let's just put it in common layman's terms for our listeners. When you apply for a job, who makes the decision on whether or not you get the job? You or the employer who you're sending the application to or submitting the application to? Well, obviously, yes. It's no hard answer here. It's the employer. It's the person who has the authority, who's in control, whose name is on the bottom line. Well, under Article 5 of the Constitution, the states submit applications to Congress. So who calls the convention, Chuck? Is it the states or is it Congress?
Congress calls
you and
it,
I
yeah.
both know. You and I both know because of plain reading of the Constitution, but we also know because of research that has been done by the congressional offices in Washington, D.C. We have the briefing, the white paper, where they spell it out that it is very clear that the Congress is the one who makes the final call for a convention and then who sets the rules for the convention, including delegate selection, the purposes of the convention, and other things. And the point is Congress can even deny the applications of the states if they don't feel that enough applications are on the same topic or are of similar enough nature to warrant a call for a convention.
Yeah, and what's interesting about this is that the whole idea that they all have to be on the same topic, that comes out of that white paper done for Congress. It was a report to Congress on what their powers and responsibilities are in the process. And essentially, it says exactly what I've been saying for a long time, and this has been a showstopper in a lot of cases on people who I've had discussions with on this. I said, you realize, of course, that what Article 5 did was take the power of convention out of the hands of the states, where it did lay in 1787, and put it in the hands of the federal government. In other words, Article 5 federalized the convention process, where in the case before, the states were sovereign, in a limited sort of sovereignty. I don't want to get into the whole sovereignty argument about who's really the only truly sovereign thing is God. God's the only true sovereign. But the states were sovereign. In other words, they were independent republics who had confederated for specific purposes, defense, diplomacy, and trade. And what the Constitution did was sort of assume some of that sovereignty. But Article 5 is a complete assumption of the power of the convention. The idea of holding a convention was not in the Articles of Confederation. It was considered to be completely within the hands and the power and the sovereignty of the states. Well, Article 5 essentially seized that authority and power and the sovereignty and put it in the hands of the federal government. That's the problem here, Barry. That's the major issue. Mm-hmm. Now, you can call it for all these things, and that's fine. And that's exactly what happened in 1787. If you read... And we have written an article that is available at the Institute for Principled Policy, www.principledpolicy.com. If you look at our Article 5 things, we've written several position papers on this, in which we show we were told by experts, now in something we're going to be doing later, you'll hear this name come up. Rob Nadelson was one of them. Some of these other guys, Mark Levin basically keyed off. He's basically parroting Nadelson. Robert Nadelson, who is a retired professor of law from the University of Montana? Montana State?
Montana.
I think that's right. And he wrote this stuff, and he said these things. He said, basically, there's no language in any of the empowering resolutions for the 1787 Philadelphia Convention that restrict any of the power of the delegates. Well, Barry, what did we find out when we... when we went through and read those and analyzed them and broke them down and talked about them? Well, the fact is, on their face, almost all of them, the majority of them, did restrict the authority. Some of them were extremely explicit about the restriction of authority of these delegates. And the fact is that the delegates basically ignored their authority, and there is a legal reason why they could do that. Now, some of them were scared about what the state legislature was going to do to them. And the answer was the state legislature could not do anything to them because, by the simple act of empowering them as a delegate to a convention, even with the restrictions they gave them a plenipotentiary authority. Delegates are not held responsible to the legislative bodies that appoint them. They're responsible to their fiduciaries, which are who? The people of the state. They are not representatives of the states. They are representatives of the entities from which they come. The political, it's called the body politic. And that's all members of society. So this idea that we're about to hear about, that somehow we're going to control it, and that don't worry because this is the one I love. Don't worry because Republicans are in charge of all the.
That makes me a little bit more worried now.
Yeah, I'm sorry, folks. We're certainly not Democrats, but we are not big fans of the Republican Party either, because it's Socialist Party A and Socialist Party B, and it just depends on, as we see these guys crossing the aisle. This is an especially telling election year, Barry, because when you see people like who were considered to be quote-unquote conservative, and that's George H.W. Bush, George Bush Sr., coming out and announcing flat out that he's voting for Hillary.
Oh, no, wait a minute. Did he announce it? Or yeah. For what I took, it was a member of the Kennedy clan who said she had a conversation with him where he told her he was voting for Hillary.
Where's the denial?
Well, you know what? Why does it matter? That's my key is, why does it even matter what a 92-year-old George H.W. Bush, who he votes for? Vote for whoever you feel like.
Barry, it matters.
It
matters because of what the two sides are standing for. And we'll get into this later if we get into it in the show.
If you believe that they're actually two sides,
that's
the other problem.
But, okay, it's how they're purported to be. It's globalism versus nationalism. That's what this election is turning out to be. It's whether we are going to go with a globalist view of government or a nationalist view of government. In other words, the nations are sovereign entities, or this idea that somehow we are under a global governance. That's where what this is turning out to be. Now, do I think both sides are really, you know, do I think the lines are all that sharp? I don't. I don't think the lines are that sharp on who's globalist and who's a nationalist. I really just don't. But that being the case, and that's far afield from where we're going. All these questions are extremely important, and you're about to hear a case, and we're going to refute them case by case as they make them. We'll stop the recording and talk about it. But should we get into the recording?
Please.
All right. Here's what we've got. We have a recording from the Glenn Beck program for September 14th, 2016. And it's an interview with a guy named Mark Meckler. Mark Meckler is the head of the Convention of States Project. And you are going to hear him make a number of claims that, again, are dubious, to say the least. And he's going to do what a lot of these guys do. Don't worry, our legal experts say this and this and this and this. Well, let me tell you something. I'm doing things by expert, not one of my favorite things. What I've come to find out is that experts very often aren't, and very often are being used to lead you down a primrose path. And I think that's what's happening here, because I can assure you there are other legal experts that think that the legal experts they cite are insane. Not in a large scope, but in a small scope on this particular issue. So I'm not saying that they should all be institutionalized. What I'm saying is that what they're saying is crazy, flat out. So here's an interview with Mark Meckler from the Glenn Beck Program.
How are we going to save our nation? How are we going to save the Republic? Who can we count on? Mark Meckler is the guy who's heading up Convention of States Project. And this is a plan that my friend Mark Levin is really big on. The Article 5 of the Constitution is quite possibly the way out. It is the big red handle right there in the cockpit that you pull and it ejects you out.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, indeed.
You got to stop right there because I've got to. Thank you very much, Mr. Beck, for that beautiful analogy on this particular process, because, yes, exactly like that big red handle in a fighter jet, when you pull it, what happens, Charles? It throws you out, right?
Yes, it sure does.
It kicks you out of the plane, and then the plane gently scoots to a landing at the nearest airfield, and you and the cockpit lid that blew off when you went out of the plane glides down and sets back on top, and so you have a nice airplane once again, right?
No.
First of all, when you pull that red handle, you are basically admitting defeat. You are basically writing off a multi-million dollar machine, and sometimes hundreds of millions of dollars, and it's going to crash, and and it's not going to be in any good shape to use anymore.
No.
And then on the other side of that coin, once you eject, depending upon where you are, I mean, if this is a training mission, obviously, it's a different story. But if this isn't a training mission and you're in actual combat situations, you pull that red handle, you may be dropping into enemy territory. And you may be dropping in a place where you're going to be in the wilderness for a while. You may be dropping, you may not even know where you're going to be dropping because you're so high up that you can't see what the terrain looks like underneath of you until you bust through the cloud layer in your chair, which you hope your chute has deployed to slow you down, which then opens up a option of if you're in enemy territory, there's a nice target to shoot at. Chuck, this is a perfect analogy.
Yes,
for
it
this
is a very good analogy for the Constitution, a Convention of States. Okay, back to it.
The founders put it there for perhaps times just like these. Article 5 and the Convention of States project, where it is, what it is, and how do we get there? Mark Meckler, he is the guy who's heading up the Convention of States projects. ConventionofStates.com is where you can find all the information. Mark, welcome to the program.
Oh, it's always great to be with you, Glenn. Thanks for having me this morning.
Thank you. Tell me, first of all, what Article 5 of the Constitution is.
Sure. Article 5 is the place that the founders put in the Constitution that allows us to get together as citizens acting through our states to propose amendments to the Constitution specifically to restrain federal tyranny. That's why they put it in there. It got put in literally tomorrow in 1787, George Mason stood up, addressed the convention 2 days before the end of a convention, and said, we have a problem. We've given the federal government the power to propose amendments, but we haven't given the same power to the states acting via the people. And are we so naive we believe a federal government that becomes a tyranny will propose amendments to restrain its own tyranny?
Okay, it's bad history. And
yes,
I wrote an article, and it's on the Institute for Principled Policy, principledpolicy.com, in which I talked about this. We had a question from someone who had listened to one of our podcasts and asked me the question. You know, the founders gave us this wonderful gift of an Article 5 convention, and I go through and tell him, essentially, I said, you've been given the impression that the convention was a monolithic body on what kind of republic we should have at the Constitutional Convention. And guys like Mark Meckler and Glenn Beck and Levin, Mark Levin and all these guys come at it from the angle that the idea of how much power the federal government should have and what the scope of the power should be was a matter of monolithic agreement. And the fact is, it wasn't, Barry, was it? There were two major factions at the Constitutional Convention. There were the Federalists and what later became known in a propaganda coup as the Anti-Federalists. Mm-hmm. Well, what we can tell you about the Federalists were, the Federalists were really nationalists. In other words, they worked diligently at the convention to eliminate the states as sovereign entities. The very thing that these guys are hearkening back to. They're hearkening back to a thing that doesn't exist anymore, and that is the sovereign states. Okay? Right. The Anti-Federalists, laughably misnamed, were the actual Federalists. In other words, they wanted to maintain a federation of independent states, federated for the purpose of defense, diplomacy, and trade. Now, this particular disagreement continued to be what amounts to a carbuncle on the body politic of the United States of America until when, Barry? I would ask you, when did this carbuncle get lanced?
I don't know. What are you thinking?
Well, the Civil War. Or,
oh, well, yes, of course. Okay. I thought you were talking about when was another convention held.
No.
There wasn't one.
No, the carbuncle, basically, the question was supposedly settled on whether we were sovereign states or a national entity in 1865. I don't think the question was really settled. But no. That is the end of the first phase of the Republic, when we went from several sovereign states to a single national entity. Okay, let's go back to it before I get too far afield.
It was just as obvious then as it is now. The federal government will never restrain itself. Thank God the founders gave us this power.
Okay, so Mark, this is not like an open convention. This is not, because people are afraid that, you know, you open up the Constitution, you go to an open convention, then, and I will tell you that with what I've learned about the American people in the last year, I'm afraid of this too. That
you should be, Glenn, because what you're about to hear is some of the most blatant forms of semantic juggling that frankly exists in politics.
Absolutely.
We're playing with the phraseology here. This isn't an open convention. This is a convention for amendments only. There is no such thing. We have the first attempt at doing an amendments-only convention was a flaming failure from that standpoint, was it not?
It was.
And actually, it was a flaming failure, and what these guys are trying to do is make it look like it wasn't a flaming failure. And that flaming failure was the Philadelphia Convention, because guess what? It was called specifically by both the Continental Congress and most of the states for the purpose of amending the Articles of Confederation. You can play semantic games all you want, but guess what? The Philadelphia Convention was a quote-unquote amendments convention. What did we get out of the Philadelphia Convention? We got a new constitution, and a vastly different constitution. Now, what you'll hear from a lot of the quote-unquote experts that we're about to hear about was the idea that, well, really, the 1787 convention actually just amended the Articles of Confederation, and that the U.S. Constitution of 1789 is merely an amendment of the Articles of Confederation. Well, Barry, we've debunked that as well in one of our position papers. Again, principledpolicy.com. So let's go back to it.
All of a sudden, you've lost the entire Constitution. This is just proposing amendments to the Constitution.
That's correct. And there's a fundamental legal difference. A constitutional convention is what's called a plenipotentiary convention. As a lawyer, as a constitutional lawyer, I can tell you what that means. It's a convention that's all-powerful. It can do whatever it wants. And what we're talking about is an Article 5 convention that operates under the strictures of Article 5 of the United States Constitution. It can only propose amendments. And folks who go to that convention can only even debate amendments that fit within the call or the application for that convention.
This is utter nonsense, as we just explained. The fact is that you can call it Uncle Sam's constitutional hoedown and whatever you want. The fact is that a convention of this type, in which delegates are given the power to propose amendments to a document, have the plenipotentiary power. All conventions are, by their nature, plenipotentiary. And, you know, don't give me political party conventions and that kind of thing, because those are not federal conventions. And don't give me state conventions. You know, why can't state conventions rewrite the Constitution? Well, they can rewrite their state's constitution, and they have. In many, 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 many occasions. Barry, how many Ohio constitutional conventions have there been?
At least three.
At least three. I was thinking there was four. There was one that they held that proposed massive sweeping changes to the Constitution that was rejected, as I recall, in the early part of the 20th century, if I'm not mistaken. Okay. Basically, none of the changes were ratified. But the fact is that if you empower people to make changes to the Constitution, they have the power to change it completely. In other words, chuck it. So these distinctions, Barry, are based on a lack of understanding, and I'm really surprised at these people, lack of understanding of parliamentary procedure. And part of parliamentary procedure is the convention process. Barry, what is the most powerful entity in any form of government?
Well, the most powerful entity is the convention.
Exactly. The convention sets the rules. It sets its own rules. So what you're going to see now coming up, and I'm going to sort of defuse what he says before he says it. What you're going to see is a claim that, well, we'll punish these guys if they don't follow the rules set by the states. You can't. You cannot hand them power and then say, well, you can only use this and this and this much of it, because the legislature cannot bind a convention member. They can't. The convention member, by definition, has more power than the legislator.
Absolutely.
And the combined legislative will of the legislature. Now, all this gets down to a term known as being a fiduciary, and you'll see this a lot in the argument. Who's the fiduciary? Well, that's the question. A convention member is bound by conscience to follow the will of his fiduciaries. Fiduciaries are the people that he represents. Does he think he represents the legislature, or does he think he represents the people in general? And does he feel bound, if he's appointed by the state, and there's no guarantee that he will be appointed by the state, does he feel bound to his legislative fiduciaries, or the fiduciary of the people of the state, or does he feel bound by the fiduciary of the people of the nation in general, or perhaps of the world? That's why we're into this globalism versus nationalism thing. Perhaps the fiduciary, he feels his fiduciary is the citizens of the world. This is where it gets dangerous. Okay.
So what would be the call or the application of this convention?
So the call or the application that's now pending all over the country has been passed by 8 states already. There'll be 38 states taking it up probably in January of next year. And that application provides for 3 subject matter areas. First is the delegates or commissioners can discuss anything that would impose fiscal restraints on the federal government. So that would mean things like a balanced budget amendment or imposing real accounting principles on the federal government instead of the fantasy accounting principles they use. So that's the first area, fiscal restraints.
Could that include the abolishing of the Fed?
absolutely would include abolishing of the Fed. It could include abolishing, repealing the 16th Amendment, the federal income tax.
Okay, Barry, here's what's funny. All these things that are talking about amending out of the Constitution, you know, amending with the this new convention, already forbidden by the current Constitution. Where in the Constitution is the federal government empowered to create a national bank? Where in the federal Constitution, the U.S. Constitution, is the federal government giving exclusive control over currency? The answer is these things don't exist. This is a difference in the view of law. Now, I would agree with them. Maybe we need to clarify it. Yeah, we need to clarify it. How do we need to do that? We need to do it through the legislative process, not through the convention process, because the Constitution is very clear. And it even says this. Powers not specifically granted to the federal government are retained by the states and the people respectively. Where is that done? That's Article 10 to the Bill of Rights.
That's the 10th Amendment.
Yeah. That's correct. It says that right there. Now, what has the Supreme Court done with that? And what has the legislative branch done with that? And what has the executive branch done with that? Ignored it. In fact, the Supreme Court said, well, that's a mere truism. In other words, we're going to do what we want to do, and we're basically going to ignore Article 10 or the 10th Amendment. Barry, they specifically debated a national bank, the allowance of the creation of a national bank at the convention. What happened to it? It got thrown in file 13. In other words, they said no. And yet by Washington's second term, what did we have? We had a national bank.
Yep.
George Washington knew this. He was president of the convention. And yet he had Alexander Hamilton had his ear. And that's why we got the national bank. And there were some shenanigans over Thomas Jefferson made a deal he shouldn't have made, thinking that he might obtain the office and kill it, and was unable to.
Anything that would deal with federal financial power. It's important to remember, Glenn, only restrictions on that power. They would not have the authority to expand that power in any way.
So they could not say, hey, we've got to be fiscally responsible, we have to raise taxes.
Anything that would expand federal power cannot even be discussed at that event.
Okay, there's equivocation there. The fact is, yes, it can be discussed. It depends on the chair, and it depends on the committees who report to the convention. It depends on how the rules are set. And what these guys are saying is that they're going to walk in with a predetermined set of rules. When has that ever happened in a convention history? What happens if the delegates don't like the rules they're restricted with, Barry?
They change them.
That's right. They change the rules.
Very simply, they just change the rules because in the convention, the delegates control it. But, you know, Chuck, we've talked about all this so many times. And, you know, there have been books upon books written about these issues. And honestly, if people like Meckler and others want to go back, I would rather read more constitutional experts from around the time the Constitution was formed, like a St. George Tucker or others, or even take a look at Kaplan's Constitutional Brinksmanship.
Yes.
You know, let's look at that book because it very clearly dispels the myth. But, you know, this is a situation where this bad penny and these foolish ideas keep turning up and turning up and turning up. And Meckler trying to make this, you see what he does is he throws out there and it's an appeal to authority because, well, he's a constitutional attorney and he's got all this experience and he's got all these legal scholars that he's going to. And again, Chuck, when you have to go there and you can't go to the text of the document, you can't go to the original writings of the founders without twisting them in order to make it say what you
want
it to
say. And that's the problem, yeah.
And that there's the problem, then there's no hope for you. You're a fool. And in the biblical sense, you're foolish.
Right.
And it's funny because I took a look while we were listening to this. I took a look and Googled up who Mark Meckler is. Well, he's an attorney who got his degree from the McGeorge School of Law at Pacific University. He's originally born and raised in California. And he worked for a number of years doing various things. But one of his things, and I thought it was funny because I just saw a feed on my Facebook. Yeah, I do keep that open while we're recording so that I can catch anything that may be coming up that's hot news. But I just got a feed from someone over to, and you know, Chuck, you and I are both part of a group that is coalesced around opposing these calls for a convention. And somebody had just posted to the group that they had just watched a stream of this conference in Williamsburg and laughed at how basically it was Meckler stroking these legislators and pumping them up. And he said he sounds like an Amway salesman. And I laughed, and I laughed hard when I saw that, because on Meckler's profile, one of the things that he did was he was a major distributor of
Amway.
Herbalife.
Oh, Herbalife. Okay.
So that whole marketing and upsell type mentality is what Meckler is relying on to talk these, well, what should be otherwise intelligent people, you hope, into believing that somehow that the little fantasy world that they've put themselves in out in Williamsburg is exactly what a fully called federal constitutional convention, convention of the states, amendments convention, I don't care what name you give it, it's the same thing. It's an Article 5 convention because there is only one. They believe that that's what it's going to look like. They're going to look around the room and see all their buddies and their friends and, you know, the conservatives from California and the conservatives from New York State, the conservatives from New Jersey, and the conservatives from Hawaii, and the conservatives from all these other states, Illinois. You think about all these liberal states, and these people are actually under the impression that that's how it's going to work.
Well, they're
that their state legislatures are going to send all of these wonderfully, mainly conservative people who all believe in God and country and all who want to save the country by fixing the Constitution, and that they're going to limit themselves and rein themselves in, and it's all going to be great and wonderful and beautiful, and the sun will be shining and the birds will be singing, and there will be joy and peace in the morning as they come together to save our country.
Morning in America.
It's morning in America.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, yeah. And basically what you just heard was there was a little spot in there where Beck comes out and says, you mean they wouldn't be able to raise taxes without a vote or that kind of thing? And Meckler immediately backtracked and said, it means that we couldn't talk about, you know, fiscal irresponsibility. So in other words, he didn't deny what Beck said, but what he did was he said, well, you know, here's what it means. He basically reiterated it. So he left Glenn Beck with the impression that what he had said was correct, which wasn't correct. So, yeah, he's a salesman. So let's go back to it, or we're going to run out of time talking about this stuff.
Okay.
All right. So the second one.
Second area, which is actually my favorite, is anything that would limit the scope, power, and jurisdiction of the federal government. So to give you some examples of...
As we've discussed, that already exists. Why do you need a constitutional convention to get an amendment that basically says that the 10th Amendment is still operative?
And the problem with that, Chuck, is that really the 10th Amendment is not operative, not because of the federal government so much, it's because of the states.
That's basically
it. It's because of state legislatures wanting federal grant monies and drawdowns and TANF dollars and Title IX funding. And I can go into, like, there's probably 3,000 different funds that come flow down from the feds to state and local governments that they don't want to give up.
Yeah.
So why is the 10th Amendment a dead letter? And why is it really ludicrous to believe that this group is going to save the country by completely changing that entire paradigm and turning it on its ear? Well, it's not going to happen, Chuck.
If the national will isn't there, this isn't going to happen, period. And the national will isn't there right now, that bottom line. Otherwise, we wouldn't elect these jokers to the office. Okay, back to it.
That much of your listeners know this better than anybody, much of the federal government operates under the alleged authority of the Commerce Clause, which gives the federal government the power to regulate interstate commerce. So it was meant as a very narrow, small, tiny enumerated power for the federal government.
Yes.
Now the Department of Education, Energy, Commerce, and many others operate under the auspices, thanks to the Supreme Court, of the Commerce Clause. We could limit that Commerce Clause, limit the federal power in the Commerce Clause, and say something like, It applies only to the shipment of goods across state lines, which is what the founders intended.
Yes.
We could dramatically limit the scope, power, and jurisdiction of the federal government. We could limit the scope of review of the federal courts, because, again, that's scope, power, and jurisdiction of the federal government. Everybody knows, 72% of Americans say the federal government is too big, too powerful, and does too much. So this is my favorite approach.
Barry, this is the biggest, juiciest, most interesting piece of irony I've ever heard in my life. Seriously.
Oh, yeah.
If you understand constitutional history, why is this? We're going to eliminate the Commerce Clause, or what it's become, the monster it's become. I want to be fair to them. They want to eliminate the monster the Commerce Clause has become. What was the purpose of the 1787 Philadelphia Convention?
Well, it was to rein in abuses of the Commerce Clause.
No, it was to insert a Commerce Clause.
The convention,
The convention was there. The convention was there to insert the Commerce Clause in the Articles of Confederation. Barry, I mean, is this not so tantalizingly ironic that we now have to fix the thing that the original Constitutional Convention was called for? And by the way, several states of the 13 basically said that's for this thing only. It's only to insert the Commerce Clause into the Articles of Confederation. So, okay, some juicy irony. I just couldn't let that pass.
Sure, absolutely.
The Commerce Clause, I had no idea how powerful it was. 10 years ago, I had no idea. I never even heard of it. Doing my homework, just limiting the scope of that completely changes everybody's workplace, or has the power to, in a positive way.
Oh, absolutely. I think that, to me, that's the single most important potential amendment.
And the third?
The third one is term limits. 80% of Americans have been in favor of term limits, polled consistently for over 30 years. The federal government will never impose term limits on itself. Congress got close once, and it got defeated by Republicans as well. So it's important to know people who have power don't generally give up that power voluntarily. Now, so Congress could have term limits imposed, but this one's more important to me, actually, Glenn, which is term limits for the United States Supreme Court and all federal judges. Founders never intended for federal judges to serve for 20 and 30 years at a time. In fact, average age of appointment was 47 at the time of the founders. Average life expectancy of a male was 54. They expected these folks to serve a few years at most, and we need to go back to something like that.
Okay, many, 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 many problems here. First of all, I'll go to the last silly argument first.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, about this whole thing about life expectancy.
Yeah, life expectancy. Okay, yes, the life expectancy of people was about 54 years. Yes, but that took into account all infant mortality, people who died from disease, and a lot of people died from disease in 1787 during this period. And the fact is that many, 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 many people lived into their 90s just like they do now.
Well, and Chuck, think about this, too. What had just happened in this country less than 7 years earlier? The War for Independence.
Yeah.
There were numerous citizens who lost their lives, and that gets calculated into those numbers,
too. Sure it does. Sure it does. So, you know, what's the infant mortality rate like now? It's really low. I mean, we have people talking about universal health care who talk about how high it is. Yeah, well, one child dead is a tragedy. One infant mortality is a tragedy, but the fact is, statistically, it's really, really, really low from based on historical standards. Okay, so that idea is wrong. Now, do I think that's actually one of the mistakes in the Constitution? Yes, I do. I think basically that Supreme Court justices and all federal judges should have been on a term, and it should have been an oddball term, probably 7 years.
Mm-hmm.
Should have been on a 7-year term, and they should be able to be reappointed if they do a good job. So basically, this lifetime appointment, you end up with federal judges like down in Columbus who are so senile, still sit the bench, and are so senile that they go to the bathroom in the closet in their office, that kind of thing. And I'm not going to say who it was, but he has a building named after him. The other part of this was, how have term limits worked out in places like, for instance, the microcosm, where you want to test it before you go to the macrocosm of the national government? How's it worked out in Ohio?
Oh, not so much.
Yeah, what has it done? Who did it empower?
It empowered the lobbyists.
Yes, and who else? The parties.
The parties, yeah.
It empowered the parties because what happened? You get people who were rogues and who did try to rein in the power of people who were in charge of the party who were basically taking us in a bad direction. So what happened to them? Well, their office expired and they weren't supported to run for instance, as someone in the House of Representatives was not basically given the support of the party to run for the Senate. Or was not given a cabinet position, or was not given something to keep their name back in the public eye so they could get back into office. Everybody you and I have personally known who has been abandoned by the party when their terms expired has had to fight tooth and toenail to get back into office to do the things that we like that they do.
Yep.
That's the bottom line. So who gets empowered under term limits? Well, it's not you, folks.
Absolutely
it's not,
not
you at all. We have term limits now. In the House of Representatives, it's every 2 years. In the Senate, it's every 6 years. In the presidency, it's every 4 years. The fact that most people come out and say status quo ante doesn't mean that you should change it. If you want them changed, vote them out. That's the bottom line.
So let me ask you this. Is there a possibility of any term limits for the federal employees as well? I'm concerned about a guy coming in with two terms starts to figure out what's going on, and then has been manipulated by the system because you're walking in with no institutional knowledge with term limits. All the institutional knowledge is there with the handlers, and that'll be controlled by somebody. So how do apart the special interest and the handlers, the term limits with the people in the State Department?
Yeah, I completely agree with you. And yes, you can absolutely do that. We can limit the terms of anybody in federal service, and we ought to. I live in California, one of the states that has term limits. I've seen the results up close. It's exactly as you describe. What it happens is it empowers this unholy alliance between bureaucrats and the lobbyists.
Yep.
And frankly, the elected officials become secondary to the process because the bureaucrats and lobbyists know they can outlast them. So in my opinion, term limits alone for elected officials is not good and probably leads to more problems than it solves.
Bingo. I mean, he just admitted it there. What he's talking about is something that was done legislatively, and that is the creation of the Civil Service Commission. Which basically says you can't lose your job. It took patronage jobs away. And what does that mean? That means that whoever holds an office gets the right to appoint members to civil service positions. Well, supposedly, this was done because supposedly a president was killed by someone who wanted a federal job and was mad because he didn't get it. Well, clearly, the guy who shot him was nuts. He was insane.
Right, exactly.
So what do? We completely flip over the way things are done. In other words, in many cases, it doesn't matter what a president's policy is or what a legislative policy is. That policy can be ignored by people who are embedded in the civil service positions.
Yep.
Department employees. Okay, if you want that fixed, you don't do it constitutionally. You repeal the Civil Service Act. It's that simple. And the fact is that the national will is not there to do that. Plus, people don't understand how that easily that could be done. All you got to do is repeal the Civil Service Act. Not only at the federal level, but at the state levels. Now, Meckler's from California. Why hasn't California done this, Barry? And what does it say about what their Constitutional Convention delegation, if by some stretch in the imagination the state legislature gets to appoint delegates, what's the California delegation going to look like?
To a constitutional... Jerry Brown.
Yes. exactly, Barry. These people...
Hillary, I can go on.
They're going to be extremely liberal. And who's going to have the biggest delegation... If we do it proportionally, who's going to have the biggest delegation at a constitutional convention?
Well, if they do it proportionally, then it's going to be states like New York, Texas,
California.
California.
Yeah, exactly.
But if they do it according to the original format, then it would be similar to the original where you had three delegates from each state. Now, The question is Congress going to allow that, or are they going to say, no, we have to do this just like the Electoral College, so however many electoral votes your state gets, that's how many delegates you're going to get to the convention?
That's actually not how that worked. There were several states that had many, like five delegates.
Oh, okay. Well, you know, you're right. I take that back. You're right. But again, that's if they do it this way, they can just say, hey, you know, if California gets 56 electoral votes, you get 56 delegates to the convention.
My guess would be more like 58.
58, okay.
Two for the senators, just like they do the Electoral College. Yeah, two for the Senate, just like the Electoral College.
Yes.
Okay, we need to get back to it because we're going to run out of time.
Okay.
So then how would you solve that if it's opened up? Because everybody will say, I want term limits, but I agree with you, and I don't have any institutional knowledge that you do. My gut just tells me that's a very bad thing without looking at the other hand.
Well, so all of that is available in convention, and I'm totally convinced that you're going to have some incredibly smart people from all over the country involved in convention. People like you and me are going to have plenty of influence in convention because this is going to be the greatest public debate in American history, possibly since 1787.
Guess what? In 1787, there wasn't any debate. You know why?
Because it was closed to the public.
The proceedings were secret.
Oh, and by the way, it's my understanding right now that this little practice run in Williamsburg, the only way that you can get it is streaming it through conventions of states, which they could consider that public in the internet age. But really what it gets down to is they're not letting media come in to look at this. And they probably wouldn't let media come in when they would do the full convention.
No, I would just about guarantee that the first vote would be to, especially if they're, here's the deal. If they're going to change things drastically, the first thing they're going to do is make the proceedings secret. And I think they're going to do that anyway because the pressure on the delegates will be so intense if it's public.
Wait a minute. Isn't that the same vote that was taken in the original convention?
That's right. The first thing they did was vote to make it a secret.
And then in the original convention, they basically said, yeah, we were all here for the purposes of revising the Articles of Confederation, but we're just going to chuck them entirely and go with something brand new that our good friend James Madison has been working on.
That was agenda item number two. They voted to eliminate the Articles of Confederation they'd been appointed to amend.
So let's guess what could happen with Mr. Meckler's fantasy convention.
And this is a fantasy.
Yes, it is.
Without doubt. Okay, back to it or we'll run out of time.
Is going to be, please. Everybody's going to see what's going on, everybody's going to know what's going on, and good conservatives all over this country are going to be very influential in the debate. It's important to remember, in convention, all states will be there.
We are refuted that point. California's going to be full of liberals, and other states, New York, Massachusetts, and other states will be split.
31 states today have both houses controlled by Republicans. So,
okay, what he said was, 31 states today have houses controlled by Republicans, and I would point to the Ohio legislature as an extremely negative example.
Well, considering that we have a Republican governor who has now gone and held a meeting and public statements with a sitting President Barack Obama to support and push for a vote on the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which the fruits of have already been harvested in part in Ohio with the announcement that McDonald's, the Golden Arches company, just laid off 70 white-collar accountants in Ohio because they get a deal from the federal government by hiring people with H-1B visas, which is what the Trans-Pacific Partnership would help to increase.
Yeah, not only do they get the lower paying benefits, they get a subsidy.
They get a subsidy. And so John Kasich went and stumped, and the first thing that happened right at almost the same time he was in D.C. saying how we got to get behind this and, you know, you got to be in favor of this partnership was that 70 white-collar jobs were lost in Ohio as a fruit of this initiative.
Yeah, back to it.
Folks who believe in limited government will be the dominant force at any convention like.
Mark, can you tell me about the possibility of hijacking in this in any way? You have had to have, known that, you know, the Soros powers and the people like that, the progressives don't want a strong constitution. They've been fighting against it. They don't want a strong nation state. They're not going to leave this alone. If this really catches, how do you protect, and what have you thought about for possible, you know, hacks?
Sure. So first, it's important to note that the radical left is adamantly against what we're doing. And you,
Barry, that is demonstrably false.
Right. There have been numerous progressive and liberal organizations that have also been calling for a convention.
Absolutely they have, because they know what they can do with it. They can eliminate the Second Amendment. There are just umpteen things that can be done with that. Okay, let's go back to it. But that is a completely laughable. What you're going to hear, basically, we're going to refute this right now, that people who he's going to strongly imply that people who are in opposition, who have issued papers and that kind of thing, are Soros-backed. Well, let's explode that myth right now. We are not Soros-backed. And by any stretch of the imagination.
You'll hear rumors out there that Soros supports this, et cetera. I can tell you his organizations right now are issuing position papers saying this is the most dangerous thing ever been done in American history. But that doesn't mean that they won't try to come and they won't try to influence what happens. I agree that they will. So there are multiple safeguards against this. On the front end, it's important to note the convention is called according to an application or resolution passed in these states. It's identical in all the states.
Okay. Just utter nonsense that somehow the application process in the states has anything to do with how we're going to protect from progressives being appointed to the convention.
And it limits what can be talked about. We have had the finest constitutional scholars in the country review this, including Robbie George at Princeton and Randy Barnett at Georgetown.
Wow.
Of course, Michael Ferris, Rob Nadelson. And we've asked them, can you put anything in under the auspices of these three areas that would expand the power of the federal government or reduce our liberty? Their collective opinion is no. The finest constitutional conservative scholars in the country. So that's number one. On the back end, the most important protection is it takes 38 states or three-quarters of the states to ratify. So this is what...
Well, that is unless the convention changes the ratification procedure, which they did in 1787. Barry, this is the most laughable thing I've ever heard. One of the powers that the convention has, because of its plenipotentiary nature, and yes, we've already proven that conventions are by their nature plenipotentiary. It doesn't matter if you restrict them one way or another legislatively. One of the powers they have is to change the ratification procedure, which they did in 1787. In 1787, to amend the Articles of Confederation required a vote, a positive vote of all 13 states. It was 100%. Now it's, I believe, three-quarters of the states have to agree to changes, but if the convention changes it, if they change the Constitution to the point where it's a new one, or if they feel like they can say, no, adoption will be by 50% plus one of an online plebiscite.
Mm-hmm. Well, Chuck, you know, all of these things just kind of tie into what I said at the beginning, and that is that this is foolishness. And, you know, Scripture is very replete, especially in the wisdom literature of the Proverbs, more than anything else, of giving examples of what the Bible means by a fool. And I think that that some of these are very, very, you know, right on point. Proverbs 14:7-8 says, "Leave the presence of a fool, for there you do not meet words of knowledge. The wisdom of the prudent is to discern his way, but the folly of fools is deceiving." Now, if they completely honestly think that they're going to control a convention and it's going to be all their good buddies there in Williamsburg and it's all going to be conservative and everybody's going to be honorable and we're going to stay within the bounds of what the states tell them to do. Well, Chuck, again, I think it's foolish. And I think that they are basically losing their perspective quickly.
Yes. And unfortunately, Barry, we are way out of time on this. There's not much left of this interview. You heard the bulk of it. It's the most important stuff. And I think we've refuted it as best we can. The fact is that this whole thing in Williamsburg is a dog and pony show. They're going to show you, they're going to release highlights to show how smoothly it can go and how they're going to do this and this. And I can guarantee you there are no progressives there to gum up the works. And the fact that Mr. Meckler's entire California delegation is going to be full of progressives. Ohio's is going to be full of progressives. We already know that from the Ohio Constitution Modernization Commission. We know the kind of people that will get appointed if Ohio gets to appoint. We know that the federal government is going to restrict delegates to, quote-unquote, constitutional and historical scholars and people who are, quote-unquote, experts. So their magic giant frat party is not going to happen. That being said, you know what we think. We want to know what you think. www.principledpolicy.com. Join us again next week for another Principles and Policies.